Welcome to the Leadership Window podcast with Dr. Patrick Jinks. Each week through a social sector lens, Patrick interviews leaders and experts and puts us in touch with trends and tips for leading effectively. Patrick is an LSI certified leadership coach, a member of the Forbes Coaches Council, a best-selling author, award-winning photographer, and a professional speaker. And now, here's Dr. Patrick Jinks.
Welcome to episode 73 of the Leadership Window. Glad to have you along. I cannot believe it's already September. This show is releasing on Labor Day, and man, this moves fast. I saw somebody the other day posted on social media something to the effect of, it's almost 2023 and I'm still processing 2020. And I could relate to that. Join the club. Welcome to that scenario. Our guest today actually is he's not going to be talking as much about 2020 and 2023 as he is about like 2030 and what's going on, because we're going to talk about the future today. And, you know, we do a lot of strategic planning with our clients. And I always say that strategic planning is really a formation of your strategic bets. And the reason I call them strategic bets is because it's a gamble. And the reason it's a gamble is because we don't know what the future is going to hold for sure. So we're setting strategy for how we're going to perform in the future and what we're going to do. And we're counting on some things falling into place to a degree. And we're measuring our risk that we're taking and how bold we have an appetite to be and all of that. And along the way, we're realizing over the last couple of years that things can change quickly. They can happen on a dime. And part of those changes are due to things like global pandemics. And part of them are just happening anyway. Part of them are the way that our technology and our brains and just the world and how things are moving is just happening. And part of that, I think, is because we're making things happen. And part of it is just we're responding to things happening. Anyway, we're going to talk all about that good stuff. If you had a crystal ball, it would be wonderful. And if there's anyone that has one, it might be my guest. He might argue that. But if there is a crystal ball for what the future of jobs and work and the workplace look like, it's probably in the head of my guest today, Ira Wolf. Ira has emerged as one of the top five global thought leaders in this field, the future of work and human resources. He's a visionary thinker in what happens when, as he says, when the shift hits your plan, and how to thrive on the never normal journey. And boy, there's so many conversations we're getting ready to have. I'm already sort of lamenting that we probably only have somewhere around an hour, because I bet this is a conversation that could go on and on. So I don't know, maybe Ira, maybe we have this conversation and then down the road we have another one. In any case, thanks for carving out time for us. So glad we're connected and welcome to the show.
Well, thanks so much, Patrick. Appreciate it. And I love that. I love whoever said that. We're almost in 2023 and still processing 2020, and I'm not sure any statement can be truer than that.
It's true, and yet, you know, how, you know, is that productive? I mean, we're still, you know, trying to figure out what just happened, and I guess to some degree we need to kind of understand it, but only as it applies to how we can make a better future. I think some of us are just lamenting and we're dwelling on what's happened. It's happened, and it's happening, and we've got to come to grips with it in some form or fashion.
And I think the biggest thing that's changed is that we've always had change.
Yeah.
But it just happened a lot slower. Mm. So if you were, you know, if we were talking about this in September and you're talking about 2023, it's like, well, when things slow down, we'll get back to it. Mm. And you've been involved with strategic planning and you know, especially in the nonprofit world with fundraising and development and anticipating, you know, what the future needs were going to be. But you'd have a plan and you'd meet and you'd go on a retreat. And you'd create this 3 to 5 year plan, and then you'd get it approved. It'd go through committees. You'd find the financing for it, and then it would roll out slowly. And in today's world, by the time you do that, everything's changed. And so part of, you know, the struggle right now is I talk about people being addicted to certainty, and that's not my words, but that's That's true. Basically the trend. We're very uncomfortable. We like predictability. We like certainty. And especially in a nonprofit world where you're basically relying on the funding of other people, whether it's government or private sources, and also the needs, anticipating what the needs, you know, might be. And the one thing that we know we don't have much of is certainty. Mm-hmm. In our world, and we struggle with it as human beings.
Yeah, absolutely. There are five questions, Ira, that I recommend to all my clients that their boards ask at every board meeting. And they all start with the phrase, with regard to our strategic plan, because we encourage our boards to stay thinking and talking at a strategic level and not getting down into the weeds. So with regard to our strategic plan, question one is, where are we? And that's the status question. How are we doing? What have we done to date? The very next question throws us into the future, because the next question is, what's next? The next question is, what's changed? And boards have got to ask the question, since we got together and formed this plan and codified it and sanctified it and blessed it and all that, what has changed in the landscape that we didn't know about? You know, it could be that one of our state funding contracts has expired, or our CEO won the lottery and resigned, or, you know, it could be any number of things that have changed that are going to have implications. And the fourth question is, what's new? And it's like what's changed, but it's focused more on opportunity. What are the new things and opportunities and potentials on the horizon that we didn't see when we gathered together to do this? And then our fifth question is, what else? But the reason we do that is because those what's changed and what's new questions have to be asked on a regular basis. You can't wait 3 years to 5 years to ask that again. Those are the continuing things in order to make course corrections in your strategic plan. I don't know another way to do it than to get intentional to say your strategic plan has to be flexible and agile, because things are going to change, and they're going to change quicker than a 3-year time frame.
Well, that's absolutely true. And as we wake up every morning and we hear new headlines, and we again have certainly a lot of uncertainty, whether it's about the economy, inflation, you know, and our democracy, you know, I don't want to go political, but there's questions continually arising, and it's just happening at a much more rapid pace. You know, they talk about it, and again, these are pretty broad terms, and they become somewhat abstract because people say, well, how does that affect me? But the reality is that the world is moving 1,000 times, that the change is happening about 1,000 times faster than it did before. And some people have reckoned it to be that the amount of change that we experienced in the lifetime of the world is going to happen in the next century. And some people, so one of the things that one of the people that I happened to follow, and I think it was just a good analogy put into perspective, was Ray Kurzweil. He was the director of engineering or chief engineer officer. I forget what his title was, but at Google. And he talks about the future all the time, and he has the law of accelerating returns. So if you would look at 2020, all those events that we had in 2020, and again, from the pandemic to the social injustices to the wildfires to the election, and that's only part of it. But we look at that whole year, and then we roll that out 20 years from now. So if you're 40 years old when you're 60, if you're 20 years old when you're 40, that pace of change, all those events would have happened within the first 3 months of the year. That's the exponential curve we're on. And then if you roll it out another 20 years, when you go 40 years out, it would happen within the first 11 days of the year. So when you talk about all these changes, and that's frightening to people, I mean, that's absolutely scary. But if you think of all the events of 2020 that we're still trying to process moving forward, still trying to make sense of, that would occur in 3 months, and then down the road in 11 days, we definitely have to learn how to deal with things, you know, faster, process it. And one of the challenges with, you know, and again, and I don't have an easy answer for this, because we have our experiences, and we still, I'm not saying throw the baby out with the bathwater, that we still have to rely on the past a bit. But the challenge is going to be our reference point is, well, we've been through this before. This is cyclical. How do we know it's not cyclical? And I talk about living in the never normal. I mean, going back to that normal, but going back to the way it was, that I'm an older baby boomer. And there's certain times that I catch myself going back to, well, in the 60s, we talk about now, this is just incredibly unusual times and scary times. But if you go back to the 60s, we had three leaders assassinated. This was like third world country stuff. Three leaders, our president, a presidential candidate, a former attorney general, and the leading civil rights leader in our country were assassinated within a five-year period. We had a war, a very unpopular war going on. We had an economy that was out of control. We had high unemployment. We had inflation. Just a few years after that, I remember being in line because I had an odd number license plate to get gas. There was a shortage of gas because our gas pipeline was cut off. So many of these things we go on, well, this is just cyclical. That was 60 years ago.
And we didn't have civil rights.
It was pre-segregation. I mean, it was not too far before that. I mean, mm-hmm. When JFK was assassinated in 1963, there was no civil rights law.
Yeah.
The successor passed that. So some of the issues we have now, we're reflecting back and you go, well, we've been through this before. But that's also a danger because it's happening so fast. It's not the only events. Fortunately, we haven't had any leaders assassinated thus far, but we've got the threats of that. Mm-hmm. But going forward, we have to anticipate so many things. And now we've got climate change to deal with. You turn on the news and there's record flooding and there's record fires and there's record temperatures and recent story about Lake Mead, it's at 27% of the level it used to be.
Yeah.
So there's all these things and it's not uniform. I mean, you deal with nonprofits, but whether you're for-profit or nonprofit, of your public sector or private sector, if you're in the West, you have different issues to deal with than if you're in the Northeast or the Southeast or the Midwest. And we try to make everything uniform and consistent and predictable. And, I call it we're living in a world of never normal, an age of never normal. And that's scary to a lot of people. And as leaders, as people who are listening to this, as leaders, we need to adjust and we need to help other people understand that and become comfortable with it. And so the strategic plans, we still need them. But they are not something you can 3 years later go back and go, well, we just did that 3 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost like, well, we just did that 3 months ago. We need to constantly be looking at it.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I'm going to take this moment right now to let our listeners know of your latest book, which is Recruiting in the Age of Googleization. I'm going to ask you in a minute what Googleization is for our listeners, but it was interesting as I was reading it, Ira, I think it came out in 2017 and then you did a revise or a re-release of it in 2020, which I'm guessing gave you an opportunity to update some things because from the time you wrote it in 2017 to the time you re-released it in 2020, I mean, a lot of stuff had changed. And now I'm reading it now going, okay, well, so it has a recent release. And it's behind on, like, there's some things in it that today you probably would write differently here as we're heading into 2023, just 3 years later. And that's how fast. I wouldn't want to be in your world where you have to write about this stuff and talk about this stuff because of how fast it changes. But it really is amazing as to how fast this really is moving. And that's one of the things I noticed in the book. I don't know if you want to comment on that, but it's kind of I'm guessing it's one of those things where you go, man, I probably need to write this book every year.
Yeah. Well, that would be tough as well. I mean, yeah. Unfortunately, production scale, well, when things are produced, if it's a pure digital version, then we can produce things pretty fast.
True.
But when it goes to print's still behind the eight ball a little bit. I mean, it takes, you know, months to do that. So I wrote the book in 2017. Really, it evolved from my TED Talk I had done so much, which I did in 2016, which was about making change work for you. So this has been my passion and always thinking forward. No idea that we were going to have a pandemic and how fast things would really accelerate. And that crystal ball that I envisioned was going to be about 2030 happened to be about 2020. So basically the book was an evolution from 2015, 2016, 2017. Published it, realized that there were things that changed, redid my second edition, or wrote, made some changes for the second edition, which came out on February 2020. So the reality is, although it was published in 2020, it was right before all the big changes that we experienced. But the theme is very much the same. And just to put this out, the book's titled Recruiting in the Age of Googlization, just for anybody who says, but we don't recruit, or that's not my interest. The first half of the book, the first 150 pages or so, is only about change. It was about the future of work. And then, you know, I work a lot with in HR and in recruitment and retention. And it was, how do I relate that back? So I wrote one chapter relating it back of how this is going to affect recruitment. And then there was I should write another chapter and another chapter and another chapter. And it turned into, I basically doubled the book. And then when we sent it to the publishers, they said, you know, this is really about recruiting in the age of Googlization. For those of you who aren't recruiters and have no interest in that, or may not hire people, really focus on the first, you know, the first 150 pages is just about change. And I could have stopped the book right there. And it would have been about what the future was going to be. And we still would have been off base. You know, it's funny, you made an intro in the beginning of the show, is that, you know, here we are recording. And the reality is we recorded this a little, you know, a week or two before it gets broadcast out. One of the things that we've got, though, is that I've got to think even 2 weeks ahead. You know, is there something I'm saying now or a week ahead? And I've been on podcasts that aren't published for 3 or 4 months ahead.
Yeah.
And that's a challenge. But I too have a podcast. We do a live version and then we do the recorded. I do a ton of writing. And those are all the updates. We're constantly thinking about how, you know, I read a headline and how did that affect how would that affect an organization? How would that affect people? And again, I just love how you open the show about we're still processing 2020, and we may be processing that for a long time.
Recording this show in advance is a great analogy to what we're talking about, because you're right. Between now and we are. I think we're recording this exactly 2 weeks before it drops. So you're listening to this now. We recorded this 2 weeks ago. Well, if you're listening to it on the day it released, we recorded this 2 weeks ago, and we don't know what's going to happen over the next 2 weeks that might have changed the course of this conversation. And I've always had to say, one of the things I've always paid attention to is I've got to be ready to pull the plug and either redo an episode if we need to, or pull one if it's not appropriate for the time. You know, I mean, you think about those things, and they change. I want to quickly go into some practical things, because I can see, man, this there's just so much to say and to ask about this. As I think about the clients that I serve, my coachees, as I call them, when I'm coaching my CEOs, there's three challenges that I can think of that are sort of the broad ones with regard to hiring. So let's talk about work. And one is, right now, we just can't find people. I mean, right now, it's just difficult to even find the right people. I'd love for you to touch a little bit on the REACH acronym, because that was a really powerful thing in the book. And what it got me to understand was that we are now the sellers. We have to sell these employment opportunities to people to make them want to come, rather than the other way around, where we feel like, oh, I go into a job interview and I got to sell myself. It's kind of the supply and demand has shifted. So that's one, is just finding people right now. A number of my clients, nonprofits from, you know, staffs of 4 and 5 people to nonprofits that are nationwide and they have 25 staff and they are 500 short right now. So that's challenge one. Challenge two is this continuing to deal with working remotely in this whole age of Zoom and all of this now. I think I've got a lot of thoughts on this, good and bad. You know, obviously the pandemic accelerated the use of virtual tools and working remote. New York Times article, I think it was a few months ago, said that the remote, that flexibility is even more important than remote. So it's not just that it's remote, that it also has to be flexible. So dealing with that and what employees want today. And then the third thing is just this, the idea that you write and think and talk about all the time. And that's just, how do we keep up with the skills and the trends to thrive in the future? And I will tell you that in the nonprofit sector, things move excruciatingly slow. I say it all the time, and I lament it all the time. We're trying to make this social change, and even sometimes not huge changes, ones that are doable in a local community, and they take 30 and 40 and 50 years, and we're still talking about them. So we're not going to be able to continue to be that way as this exponential change you talk about continue. So those are the three things I'd love to get your thoughts on. One, the you know, finding people and what that requires today. Two, this dealing with the challenges of remote and the technology and virtual work. And three, just keeping up with the skills. I know your book talks about what are the top skills needed in the future. What should we be thinking about developing? So those are the three challenges I'm seeing on a pretty daily basis with the clients I work for. Is it much different in the corporate sector or within the people that you're working with across sectors?
No, absolutely not. And again, we do work with a few nonprofits. We work with primarily anybody who hires people or who has people and they're trying to retain them. And that's certainly nonprofits. But nonprofits are competing with private. Private doesn't have enough people in them. There is, you know, we can certainly get into this a little bit. What are the advantages? How can you attract and retain people when you're competing with private? And then public sector is really suffering. And there may be some organizations that overlap with that. I mean, I just did an article and an interview about the public sector. And, you know, in the city of Philadelphia, there's 7,000 openings. They haven't had a firefighter and paramedic class in a year and a half. They had four times the number of policemen who retired than they recruited. They're competing with private sector, in the trades and construction for building inspectors. So now we have a safety and security issue. But we also have a welfare, you know, the well-being. I mean, we have a lot of people that are suffering. We definitely have more. You talked about skill changes. There was just an article in the Wall Street Journal, and they looked at five skills college students should have. One of those skills was dealing with natural disasters. That's a skill that we're going to need to have. And certainly planning for those is one thing, but we're dealing with them. This is happening right now. And so, having people that are more proactive, more visionary, more aggressive at the ability to deal with that. But then we have to have who's going to pay for that and who's actually going to do the work. Because those jobs aren't going to be high paying. They usually, you know, disaster cleanups often relied on volunteer organizations, nonprofits, Red Cross, and how do we keep them funded? How do we train the people? How do we find the people? If there's shortages at work, then organizations and corporations may not have the luxury of saying, yeah, you can go off and help those people for a month. So there's implications all the way down the line that we need to look at. But going back, let's unpack that a little bit, because this could be a 9-hour documentary.
Sure. Yeah.
there's a lot here. But let's go back to some basics. Just so for anyone that thinks that we have labor shortages because of the pandemic, you just have to get that out of your head. I started talking about something called the perfect labor storm in 1999. That became my first book. And as far back as almost 25 years ago, we were talking about labor shortages because of demographics. Of course, people thought that was going to be far and away, and that's not going to happen in our backyard. But the reality is, is that this is just demographics, and this is easy for people to understand because it's just pure numbers. So in the 60s, in the late 50s, 60s, and early 70s, we had the baby boomers coming in, me, you know, my generation, coming into the workforce. There were 2.5 million new workers entering the workforce every single year for about 10 years. And then there were so many baby boomers, and we still had the older generation, what they called the veterans or the traditionalists, those coming out of World War II, they were still in the workforce. And then we had Gen X, and it was a smaller organization, but we basically had enough people, and we had a little bit of new blood. And then we had the millennials, and the millennials was even a larger generation than the baby boomers. So again, in the late 1990s and early 2000s, we had 2.5 million new workers. Now, not all of them were good workers. Not all of them were skilled. Not all of them were educated. Not all of them had a great attitude. But that's in every generation. We won't go into that, the millennial thing. But basically, we had a lot of people to choose from. And we had a huge immigration population. And then we hit 2020. And what it looks like now is where we used to have 2.5 million new workers a year, we have less than 500,000, because our birth rate has fallen from 3.6 in 1960 to 1.6. So we're just not having babies in our country, we're not having large families. So one of the problems, we just don't have enough bodies. At the same time that's happening, we don't have a large number of immigrants coming. And at the same time, the baby boomers are retiring, or unfortunately, some are dying. I mean, baby boomers are now in their 80s. So and that's just part of the challenge. And our population has doubled in the last 60 years. So we have a larger population, an aging population, fewer workers coming into the workforce, no immigration, and the baby boomers are exiting, but still need services. They need healthcare services. They're building homes. They're moving. They like to be entertained. They like to travel. They need investment. And behind the scenes, technology is changing everything that we do. For one of the things, and again, I know you briefly mentioned this, just about flexibility. Can you imagine 2020 if we did not have Zoom? What would have happened to all the people that they were able to continue to work? Nonprofits were able to continue doing things, or private sector, public sector. The Social Security is still remote. They still have their workers remote. So there's people, our systems functioned because technology was there to pick it up. But if it happened in 2010, we didn't have the bandwidth, we didn't have the internet, we didn't have the software, we didn't have the technology to be able to function. And instead of having a million deaths, we might have had 2 or 3 or 4 million. We would have had people that would had to go to work because it was the only way that they could have gotten work done, and put their lives in danger, no matter what it was. So I have a different view on technology. I don't think it's the end all and be all, but technology was there when we needed it, and it probably saved millions and millions of lives and businesses, and allowed us to come back out of here. But just from the shortages, we will have shortages. And how is it going to impact the nonprofit and public sectors, as well as for-profit? If for-profits are struggling, they've got the money, they've got the power, they got the resources. It's going to make it highly competitive to be able to continue to recruit people.
Yeah, interesting stuff. And I won't argue this, but I'll throw out a couple of provocative challenges for people to think about, including you and me. You're right. The workforce is shifting. The population is shifting, all of that. But the Great Resignation is very real. I mean, these shifts from, the number of workers per generation, that didn't happen in 12 months. You know, this has happened really quick. And I know that a lot of the people that I'm working with, I'm seeing it on the ground of people just saying, they just never came back, after the pandemic and it went virtual or we downsized or whatever. It's like, you know what? I figured out I probably don't need to work right now. So a lot of people are saying this is going to bounce back, right? The Great Resignation is going to turn, there's going to be a surge And what I'm hearing you say is maybe not, because if you take the other end of that stick, it is that the actual population of available workforce is shifting as well. And some of those other sort of longer term evolutionary changes on top of it may at the very minimum may slow down any kind of bounce back in this great resignation dynamic we've experienced.
The pandemic didn't cause, and I'll keep saying this over and over again, the pandemic did not cause the situation we're in. And that's the first premise that people, the first assumption that every organization, every leader needs to get over. One is the millennials didn't cause this. The pandemic didn't cause this. This was coming down the pike. And we joke about the crystal ball, but most of us who follow these trends didn't need a crystal ball to say that at some point we were just going to have more jobs than people. It was just in the numbers. It was in the demographics. I'm not the researcher behind a lot of this. I sort of collate this and study it and then I just put it out to the masses. And where we were wrong is we expected the tipping point to be 2025, 2030. And then 2020 hit. And it took out a lot of people, but it changed the dynamic. So going back to the nonprofit world, you know, one of the, and this isn't strictly for nonprofit, but one of the biggest challenges of getting people back to work, we took 4 million working women, professional women, out of the workforce who have not come back into the workforce for a variety of reasons. And one of the reasons is lack of childcare. You know, part of it is having that better life, having more flexibility, being able to spend time with your kids, not having to do a 2 or 3 hour commute instead of being at a 2 or 3 hour ball game, you know, with your kids and watching them grow up. So we had all those issues. But the other challenge is, even if it's, you say, hey, we're going to go back to hybrid, we need you to be back at work at 2 or 3 days a week. And many people are fine with that. The problem is where do we get childcare for 2 or 3 days a week? People can't get it for 1 day a week. And why don't we have childcare? Well, there's a whole host of reasons why we don't have childcare. But, you know, it's anywhere from regulations to where's the childcare located? So we had a lot of the childcare was located in lower income areas or lower income people, because it's a low paid profession, came from there. But then you have high inflation costs, so people can't hop the bus or drive because it costs too much money to earn, you know, $10 or $12 an hour.
But that's not a new challenge, is it, Ira? The childcare?
Yeah, when you don't have enough people, it is. Yeah, I mean, because basically you could have childcare in an area, it didn't take much to have somebody take kids into a home. You know, and there were regulations, but it's gotten much more acute because a lot of people decided they didn't want to do that. People were cautious about sending their kids to certain childcare centers, you know, because of the health. What happened at the regulations? I mean, my own grandkids were my daughter-in-law works. She sent the kids. Either the school was closed down, where the child came in with sniffles and was sent home, that somebody had to pick him up. So there's a lot of dynamics, and I'm not an expert in childcare. Yeah. All I know is that there's a huge, huge shortage of childcare, which is inhibiting people from coming back to work. And the burden still falls on women as the primary caregivers to be able to do that. So there's a lot of challenges, but we can't afford. We're in the past, it might have been a little ripple in the pond if you lost 4 million women from the workplace or they can only work remote. Now it's a big, big deal because we just don't have them. And if you look at professional jobs, if you roll back the clock to 1950, there was only 1 out of 3 women worked, and only 2% of the entire population of women went to college. Now you have more college grads who are women. They're, you know, physicians, attorneys, engineers, accountants. Those were all male-dominated professions. Now they're female-dominated professions. And if you don't have childcare,
yeah,
they can't go to work.
Yeah,
and they're providing needed services.
Yeah, I guess what I'm what's running around in my head, and we'll move on to other topics, is I hear you on the, you know, this, we got to get over this, the pandemic didn't cause this. I'm struggling getting past that completely, though, because of how fast during the pandemic and today, how fast the workforce shrunk. And I guess what I'm saying is, can that speed of how fast this thing shrunk be all this combination of evolutionary things? At the very least, would it be fair to say that the pandemic accelerated or you know, served as a, you know, icing on the cake kind of thing? Because you know, you talk about people not coming back to work. My question is why they left work. And we know how I don't know the number, but we know this, there's this huge, you know, from 2020 of people that have left the workforce. One of the reasons unemployment has been lower is because they're not in the labor force participation rate, because they're not going back. And again, this is partly on the research and partly on, you know, just all the organizations that I'm serving that are saying, you know, when we downsized or when we had to shut down for, you know, X period of time, when all the unemployment and stimulus benefits went out to everyone for so long, many of those people said, you know, I don't really need to go back. And I guess I'm having a little difficulty understanding, if you're saying it's not the pandemic, what role would you say the pandemic has played then in all of that?
Yeah, that's a great question, Patrick. I think you hit the nail on the head. It accelerated it, but it did one more thing. It pulled back the curtain on how fragile our entire system was. These things were building up. We knew we were going to have a shortage of skilled labor. We're going to have a shortage of labor, and then we're going to have a shortage of skilled labor because of our education system. You're right. We've had problems about childcare, but it accelerated that because the dynamics changed a bit. There were transportation, real estate. I mean, it impacted everything. But the reality is, it definitely accelerated. It happened overnight, literally March 16th. Yeah. People said, "Don't come back to work," and it's only going to be 2 weeks.
And
so
they didn't.
It'll be a month. So it'll be 3 months. So it'll be, you know, a year. Now it'll be 2 years. And it'll be 3 years. So it accelerated all that. Literally, it happened overnight. But the other part of it is, we had a very, very fragile system, and we were getting away with it. And we talked about strategic planning. Let's talk about right before the pandemic, October of 2019. I was the keynote presentation at a Workforce 2030 conference, and 4 months later, everything I talked about,
the shift hit the plan.
exactly. Everything that happened, we didn't anticipate. Well, unless Bill Gates anticipated a pandemic, but he didn't pinpoint it to March 2020. And had that been the case, then, you know, maybe I'm not sure we could have planned a whole lot better, but we could have planned a little differently. So the pandemic definitely had an impact, but it didn't cause it. And I strongly am of the belief that it pulled back the curtain on a very fragile system, similar to, I guess, the next closest analogy would be, you know, in 2007, 2008, we had a very fragile banking system, finance system.
Yeah. In 2001, you know, September 11th. I mean, 9/11,
fragile building, right?
That's a great point, Ira. What it revealed, you know, that it did reveal a lot of cracks in the foundation, which really sort of is a segue into one of my other questions, and that is around the difference between adapting to change, and I'd love if we've got the time to hear about your adaptability quotient. So we deal a lot with emotional intelligence, and I know that the adaptability quotient is different than that, but we talk about adapting to change. In other words, you know, what do we do when change happens? But there's the other side of the equation too, particularly this is a leadership tenet, and that is creating the change, you know, being a part of what is actually making the change happen, not just responding to some external force that we can't control and being able to react and adapt to it, but literally to create change before it's needed. I love Simon Sinek's, one of his latest books, if it's not his latest book, The Infinite Game, where he talks about an existential flex, that ability to make change before change is actually needed, in anticipation that that's what's going to be required for relevance down the road. And that's so difficult. I mean, that's difficult for anybody to understand. I certainly know it's difficult. I work almost exclusively in the nonprofit sector. So that is such a tough concept to grasp, is changing before you need to and not just reacting to change. What's that balancing act in your world as you're helping people deal with change? And where does the actual creating of change come into that equation for you?
You know, it takes me back. Actually, the logo of the business I just sold was about a paradigm shift. And, you know, we have businesses go through curves, and I know people are listening, so I'll try to visualize this. But you think about a growth curve that, you know, it starts low and then you get an S curve. So basically, you start at the bottom in this slow growth, and then all of a sudden it accelerates, and you're rising pretty high, and then you get to the top. And oftentimes you flatten out the curve starts to go down a bit. You start to return. And then that's when people wake up and go, oh, we need to change things differently. But what if you could anticipate? What if you said, we're near the peak, we're 80% to the point, and we recognize that we're going to hit what Dan Sullivan used to call the ceiling of complexity. Mm-hmm. It's just the shift is going to hit our plan. And so instead of waiting until things start falling apart to fix it, we anticipate it. And now you start another S curve, you start another curve. And they overlap. And the region between that rising peak and that new peak is an area of chaos. That's the dysfunction, is where we've got one foot in the past. We're trying to steal second base, but not leave first. You know.
Oh, I love it. I love baseball analogies, and that's a good one.
And that's the challenge. But we're there now. And the problem is those ceilings, the complexity, are hitting us, and that stuck with me. You know, I know we talk about leaders, and that was something that really changed my viewpoint. And then I saw that written in a book called Mission Possible. And when I read that, and that was the visual that said, oh, this is what it's about. This is it. And what's happening now is we're living in that area of complexity all the time. You know, especially as leaders. I mean, you know, there's obviously people that are I won't say the followers, but the residents, the people who need our services, the employees, they're looking to the leaders to figure this out. And the leaders are living in this area of complexity, or maybe beyond what I call VUCA, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous, you know, time. So we have to figure that out. So I know you asked a couple questions in there, but again, things, you know, the pandemic has definitely shifted things. We're living in this area of uncertainty and complexity and ambiguity. And we need to, you know, we need to always be, we need to have our heads on a swivel. We need to be always looking 360. And again, leaders are human beings. We're human beings. We like some predictability. We like some certainty, and our jobs depend on it, because no matter if you have a small business or a big business, whether you're public or private sector, whether you're nonprofit or private or profit for profit, we all have people that depend on us.
I've got
we make decisions.
Yeah, that's right. And they do look to us. And this is, this relates to a portion of your book where you talk about making sense of the environment. First of all, sensing the environment and its changes, and then making sense of that input, and then deciding on an appropriate action and acting on that decision. And it brought me to one of my colleagues talked about this on a show early on in this podcast, when I first started it, about how one of a leader's big job is sense making. And what we found during the, you know, fairly early stages, or, you know, as we got deep into this pandemic and shutdowns and organizations having to figure out how they're going to downsize and cut, and are we even going to remain open, and what emergency funds out there are available to us, and all these things, what we found is that people are, people are more afraid of the uncertainty than they are a negative. They'd rather know, like, this is, you're going to lose your job, than to not know. Like, you know, that if a leader can make sense of it and say, look, here's the reality, here's the course of action, here's why. There's, you know, maybe scenario A is the worst case and we're going to be preparing for that. Scenario B is maybe the most likely case. And scenario C is, you know, we may come out of this ahead and we're preparing for all three, but it's really looking like these things are going to happen. And just making sense of that, and for people to be able to see that their leaders acknowledge, yeah, we're in a crisis. Yeah, this is tough. Yeah, we have tough decisions to make. Here's how we've made sense of it. And here's the decisions we're looking to make. While those decisions themselves are not always attractive, the fact that they are made and that they are made on data and information that is communicated replaces, oh my gosh, what's going to happen?
Yeah, I can't. That's so powerful, Patrick. And I can't think of, you know, my mind immediately went to all these companies having layoffs. Mm. And you know, I guess on the one hand is that they've made a decision and the people, at least people know what the direction is. They're not sitting there waiting. I wonder when the next shoe is going to drop or when it's going to happen to me. So they, at least they know and they can move forward rather than living in that sense of uncertainty and ambiguity. The problem is it still hurts.
It does.
And
yeah.
It's in the communication that if they receive the message over a text message, yeah, it's one thing. Versus how did leadership respond? How was it communicated?
Yeah.
Did the workers know in advance of reading it the headlines? Or did they read the headlines and find out that their job was at stake, you know, or that they lost their job?
Good point. So that's the emotional intelligence piece of leadership.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And even beyond that, and you mentioned earlier, you talked about the AQ, the adaptability quotient.
Yeah.
And it's not, you know, it's not just, oh, here's another assessment or here's another a model that we're going to use. But we're living in this area of the area of never normal, and people need to become better equipped. But there's two sides of that. So we rely on what we've developed is called the ACE model, A-C-E. So it's abilities, character, and environment. And the abilities are abilities that all of us as individuals need to develop. And many of the listeners are familiar with grit. You know, it's like, what's the problem with people today? We need people who are gritty, that they stick with it, that they persevere. That's part of it. We need people that are resilient, that, hey, we bounce down and we'll bounce back. The problem is resilience is not the opposite of fragility. This came
right
from Nassim Taleb.
Yeah,
right. The opposite of fragility is anti-fragility. And anti-fragility is when my description of that is you have a porcelain cup and you throw it down as hard as you can to the floor and it will shatter and that's fragile. But what if it hit the floor and instead of fracturing, it actually became stronger? It regrouped, it changed its molecular structure, and it became stronger. And then it bounced again and it became even stronger. And then it bounced again and it not only became stronger, but it bounced higher. That's anti-fragility.
Yeah.
So when the problem with grit and resilience is based on a fragile model that we need to resist, let's make it stronger to begin with, but it's still going to fracture. And eventually we're talking about human beings. Eventually we all have a breaking point. So a third component about that is, which is my passion and where I'm spending most of my time, hopefully helping people with, is growth mindset. Is how do we get people, you mentioned it in your five steps of how do we get people to think differently? And we have an exercise that we use and it's called the Yeti. You know, the old abominable snowman. It's Y-E-T-I. And it says, well, let's take it down to an individual level. I'm just not very good at technology. I'm not very good at being on screen. I'm not very good with math. I'm not a good leader. I'm not a good parent. Pick whatever you say, you're not very good at. I'm too old to do this. Okay, write it down. It's a fact. You believe it. That's your perception. And now, but after that, go yet. Yet is a three-letter word filled with hope. Think about this as nonprofits. We can't do this because we don't have enough money, or our funding is short, or we're not, whatever the reason might be. You're much more familiar with all those reasons. What are the reasons? And if you put yet after that, now you've got hope. What does that look like? And then it's the yet I, the Yeti. Yet I will, what will you do? Now, I guess we can do the yet they. Yet they or yet we.
We, yeah.
Okay. You know, what can we do about that? But yet is this word that takes a pause and it injects hope into whatever you're doing. And then the conversation isn't about, well, how do we deal with the world with, you know, in spite of all those flaws that we, well, we're how do we deal with the world in spite of all those flaws? But instead of focusing on, well, we have less funding, or we can't do this, or again, I'm too old, I'm not good at math, I'm not good at technology. What can you do about that? And it changes the conversation. And that's growth mindset. And then the other two is about mental flexibility, dealing with misinformation, and or dealing with a lot of information, and then unlearning. And we talk about learning all the time, learning new skills, but we need to unlearn. Some things just aren't going to work the way they used to. We need to not keep doing the same things over and over again. You know, what was referred to Einstein's, you know, famous quote.
Yeah.
You know, if you keep doing the same things over and over again, expect a different result. It's a description of insanity, whether it be actually said that or not. We won't go into that. But it holds truth. So we need to not only learn new things, but we need to unlearn. But growth mindset's the start of all this, and that those are the individual skills that as individuals we need, but we also work in an environment. And the environment, and this is where it shifts with the great resignation. There will be companies that and organizations that do well in spite of this great resignation, in spite of the labor shortages, the shortage. And they're going to do it because there's three dimensions that are really, really important, and they lead to a fourth. One is company support. Do your employees, and maybe in nonprofits, it's more, do your stakeholders and employees believe that management understands their needs? Does management have their back? Does the board of directors have everyone's back? The second part is team support. And this has come out for years and years and years, is people don't work for the company or the organization. Now, today it's shifting a little bit. They work for the purpose and the cause, but they work because they enjoy the people around them. They feel that the manager and their coworkers have their back, that they're supported, that they enjoy being with them. That's their family. And that's one of the things that remote work takes away, is that mm-hmm. that connection. And but there are ways to work on that. So that's the yet I. Yep, you can mm-hmm. do it. Through even if you're remote. And then the other is the environment. What are the workplace policies? Do they support that? Are people treated fairly? What's compensation look like? Do you provide the people with the resources? If they have to come into work, do you take into consideration the high cost of gas and travel and commute times? And do they have to come in for that meeting? Or maybe you can do it over remote and give them a half a day that they don't have to come in. So there are ways what are the workplace policies? So it's company support, team support, and work environment, having a psychologically safe space to try new things. But all that amounts to is employee well-being, emotional health, the emotional health of individuals. And you mentioned flexibility. Flexibility is a solution to what people recognize is they were getting stressed out and burnt out. They became more comfortable working at home, despite the fact that they had that disconnect with friends and family or friends and workers and so forth. But their well-being, they just felt better. They were healthier. They weren't always stressed out. And the emotional health of individuals is going to be key. And this is, you know, I mean, that's the role of many nonprofits is looking out for the well-being of both the physical, social, financial. There's a lot of different aspects of well-being. And that's a huge opportunity. And that's going to be a huge role. Nonprofits are going to have a huge role. And one is helping for-profits deal with this challenge of whether it's labor shortages or the Great Resignation. Corporations aren't going to figure it out. I'll guarantee you that.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I've coached a not insignificant number of leaders for whom the remote work has had a negative impact on their emotional well-being. You know, like it worked the opposite for them. They needed that physical connection, that place of belonging and that identity and they have not yet figured out a way to find that remotely. I'm going to give you one of my big pet peeves. I'm very open about this. And even with my clients, and many of them don't like it. Many of them agree with me. This virtual stuff is killing me. Now I'm a Gen Xer who's pretty technically, you know, adept at things. I run a podcast myself. I do videos. I got computer stuff. I build my own website. Technology doesn't bother me. I keep up with it at least as well as the average guy. But let me tell you what I'm observing with this Zoom dynamic is, and this is one of those things that I think the pandemic perpetuated, not caused, but maybe definitely accelerated. We had Zoom before the pandemic. And as you said, fortunately we did, because look what it was able to do for us. However, what I'm finding now is Zoom is an easy out for a lot of people who don't want to take the time and the effort it takes to get dressed, get in their car, and go meet with some people, go to work, go to a board meeting. Board meetings, more of them are not just virtual, but hybrid. And this is the piece that's really that I'm having the most difficulty with is these hybrid meetings where 15 people are in the room and then 5 people are on the Zoom call on a screen or on a laptop. And it is so, so, so very difficult to engage an entire group with each other in that way. I know the tricks and tools. I'm a professional facilitator and I've leveraged a lot of them and the creative use of break rooms and how to make sure you're engaging both and how to build exercises around whatever. It is not the same. And it drives me crazy. And my point is not that I don't like the technology. My point is that the technology has created an easy out for board members to say, I'll call in, I won't be able to make it. Or for staff to say, yeah, I'm going to need this to stay a remote job. I'm just going to need this. Or I'm not going to be in today, but I'm going to work virtually. To the point now where I just read this thing in the New York Times. It was a really interesting article because it was online about how now there's software that's tracking your hours online for remote workers. They're literally tracking your activity to the point where if your mouse doesn't move for 15 seconds, you're getting docked points. Like it's really, really crazy algorithms that they're using to make sure that these remote people are productive. And they're not taking into consideration any of the things like, hey, I need 3 minutes to sit and think about this, or I need to use the restroom, or, you know, whatever. So it's getting to the point now where the productivity, I've got leaders saying, yes, productivity has dropped. Some are not saying that, but this easy out, that I think this remote thing is causing now. What's your take on that? You can totally shoot it out of the water, but it's driving me nuts as a coach and a facilitator.
Yeah. So there's a couple things there. So let me do the one that you ended with, about measuring people's performance by their activity, their busyness, B-U-S-Y-ness.
Yeah.
That's absurd. You know, frankly, and there's a couple articles that have talked about this. A couple leaders have been talking about it. Companies didn't really know how to measure performance for knowledge workers before. I mean, and again, when we talk about remote work, we're talking about knowledge workers, service workers, because there's 60% of jobs at this point still can't be done remote. You have to be there. You have to physically be there to do the job. Mm-hmm. We're not quite at the autonomous truck driving stage yet. We need nurses. We need healthcare. You need a dentist. There's certain jobs that have to be have to be remote. So we're talking about 40% of the jobs. Out of those 40% of the jobs, we have no, companies have no clue how to measure performance.
Right. That's right.
They just don't. So they revert back to, we need to see people working. If we can't see them, we're going to track their mouse movements and the number of keystrokes they have. Yep. That's absurd.
It's scary. I mean, and these are big, you know, go to the article.
Yeah, it's beyond the privacy issues. Yeah. It's just,
but these aren't unknown companies either.
No. I'm not saying it's right. I'm not saying that at least from my opinion, and I'm backed by a lot of people as well. It's really a dumb policy. Is you need a better metric. Yeah. The metric isn't how many move their mouse every, if they don't move their mouse in 3 minutes, they're not productive.
Yeah, or your keystrokes.
And what are we paying me for? That's just absurd. Just take that out there. You need a different way to measure performance in what we're calling an everywhere workplace. Okay. It's not perfect. It's not going to be for everybody. It's going to be an evolution. We're going to make mistakes. It's that growth mindset. We're on a journey. And we got to figure this out. But we need a different way to measure performance. And measuring keystrokes and mouse movements and eye movements is not it. We just need a different way. Because there are studies that are out there that the remote workplace or the hybrid workplace is more flexible. Mm-hmm. So you're going to see studies on both sides that don't work. But ultimately, we need a better performance metric, you know, when we do that.
I think that's a good place to pause and ask our listeners. And this is a coaching question for our leaders that are listening right now. We don't have the answer to that. I mean, Ira, you just said we need a different one. You didn't tell us what it was. You just said we need a different one because we don't know yet. But ask yourself that question. What is it you need from your employees? What is it you're looking for? How would you define success in productivity? How would you define, but for the fact that we had you, we wouldn't have been able to have this. And I think we've got to just ask that simple, basic question. That's the starting point for me in determining any complex metrics. Let's not worry about some, you know, we need to design the next algorithm. Let's just ask ourselves the question, what are we actually paying people for? And how do we know when we're getting it? And to your point, it's not keystrokes and mouse movements.
Yeah. Patrick, I've been asking that question at interviews before the pandemic.
Yeah.
And people didn't know the answer. So
no, they don't.
We were in the test. We were in the pre-employment and leadership testing business. That was my prior business. Mm-hmm. And I'm still in that business. We're just owned by Dame Leadership in the moment. And we're integrated into there. But the one question I asked for years at an interview, or not in an interview, when a manager called me up and they said, hey, do you have a test for this? And my question was similar to what you just said. At the end of 12 months, this employee you have them under your payroll. You're sitting down for, and I don't recommend just an annual review, but you're sitting down and reviewing their performance over the past year. What is it that they had to accomplish? And I will tell you that 90 some plus percent of the time, they had no clue.
Yeah.
Well, we need them to show up. If they show up 100% of the time on time, you're good. No. They got other job. Okay. What is your expectation that they're sitting across from you and you say, I want to clone you. You have exceeded my expectations. What is it that they had to do for you to say that? And they don't know. So therefore, what we need to do is we need to measure keystrokes and we need to measure attendance as substitutes for performance.
Yep. That's right. And, you know, it sounds elementary and it sounds insulting to the sector and leaderships. And of course, there are exceptions out there, but you're right. They know it intuitively. They haven't paused to how do I articulate it and how do I visualize, how do I crystallize it? Because even if the leader knows it, does the employee know it? Does the employee know what it is the leader's looking to me for to achieve and succeed? Anyway, boy, we get into a lot of stuff.
But the metrics are, we're still basing metrics on production output, creating widgets.
Yeah.
It's still based on an industrial world measurement. And we had this gradual movement over to knowledge workers And we still applied the same metrics and same systems to that. And again, the pandemic just pulled the curtain back on, hey, that wasn't working before. Yeah. We'll just blame it on the pandemic.
Yeah. Hey, I'm bouncing all over the place on this, I realize, and I'm sorry if I'm cutting off deeper thought on this, but there's a couple more things I want to get to before we wrap up. I want to thank you for one particular element in your book, this VUCA, which is volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity. Been around a while, I've seen it, and it is this sort of, you know, leader's ability to manage in those circumstances, and these are the realities. And as every time I've looked at VUCA, I have thought, and I've never done it, I've thought, you know, we need an antidote. We need some other acronym that isn't these. You talked about hope. You know, let's create some hope and let's frame these situations different. The yet is a perfect example of it. And it's coming up more and more on our episodes. I want to say almost every episode now, we're getting in some conversation to some degree about appreciative inquiry and about reframing, you know, problems to solutions. And instead of saying, what are the barriers, you know, what are the barriers to success? And then we fixate on the barrier. Rather than that, we're saying, what is it going to take to succeed? You know, it's like, let's talk about the proactivity, those things that we can control and do. But as I'm going through the book and I see VUCA and I'm going like, yep, oh, here's VUCA again. And then you hit on the antidote, a new, not even just a new acronym, the same acronym, VUCA. But instead of volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity, what if we framed it for leaders as vision, understanding, clarity, and agility? All the things we've just talked about for the last 60 minutes. And we don't have time to go deeper into it, but a while ago when you were talking about the Yeti and the, you know, not yet, and framing it in a positive way and then appreciative inquiry, I lit up when I got to that part of the book of a new or an antidote or balancing act for VUCA. So I just want to pause on that and appreciate that.
And thank you. And that was the topic of my TED Talk. I was introduced to that 20 some years ago. He is one of my favorite thought leaders is Warren Bennis. And, he mentioned that he was the one that developed that. And then it was adopted by the military services of planning for our future. So I appreciate you bringing that up. And that really shaped my role, my vision. I want to go back, and this may tie this into beyond. How do you put the power of that? How do we turn that into something that people can use? And this goes back into how can organizations get people to connect? How can we get individuals? You talked about how remote loses the personal touch. And a colleague of mine, a friend of mine, has developed what he calls the four C's. And the four C's are the four connections. And a lot of people have now dropped out of the workforce or pulled back or entered this great resignation because they reconnected to themselves. And so there was a connection to the self, self-awareness. There's a connection to others, which is missing. And some people have been comfortable, introverts, and some people said, I've been able to connect and I do it at my pace and I really like this remoteness and I can back down, I can turn off my screen or I don't have to, you know, after a big meeting, I can pull
Don't get me
back.
Started talking about the black screens on Zoom meetings. Don't yeah, get me that, on that.
Okay. So, but yeah, I'm not advocating that, but people have figured out how to manage that.
Yeah.
So, but we're lacking that. Where people need, even if it's only one close friend, people need that. And so there's a connection to self and a connection to others. But then there's also a connection to the job, a connection to the role. And that's one of the things that had the pandemic only lasted a month and everybody went back to the workplace, we wouldn't be having this discussion. We would still be maybe spiraling downward, but we wouldn't be having this discussion yet. But because people had now over 2 years to reflect of what my life is going to be, what my job should be, how do I connect? How do I get passion? How do I enjoy getting up every morning and going to work and being part of that? So there's a connection to the role and connection to the organization. Do my values align with that? So we have connection to self, role, others, or connection to self, others, role, and organization. you were so right. There is a lack of that. That's why people were dropping out. So company organizations, whether, again, doesn't matter if you're for-profit or nonprofit, organizations that are figuring this out will be able to attract more, but also retain their current people. And it also has proven that people that are connected and aligned and have a, that feel that there's a purpose, that they're working for a greater cause, it will are people that don't leave. They enjoy it. They're engaged. I mean, Gallup just came out with their State of the Workplace report, and 19% of people are miserable. That means yesterday they were sorry, they felt sad, worried, angry, distressed, or pain within the last 24 hours. One out of five people are miserable. The bar is really, really low for organizations to do a little bit to get it right, to be able to attract people. And part of that is that lack of alignment. How do you get people to feel that there's a purpose? So so we talk about these four connections. How do you get the four connections? We're working with a group called the Why Institute, and the Why Institute looks at aligning people's purpose. What's your why? I will tell you what my why is. My why is contribute. And it was understanding how could other people benefit. And I'm for profit. So it sounds like it's all nonprofit, but I'm a capitalist as well. And I'm an entrepreneur. Is how can other people benefit from what I provide? You know, I started as a dentist. I was a dentist, but part of that was to give me an opportunity to be involved in the community, to participate. I still sit on boards. I still offer my time. The job allowed me that luxury to be able to do that. But I left dentistry because dentistry didn't do it for me. It didn't change me as a person. It didn't change what I did. I wasn't aligned with the role I had or the job I had, but my value was about contributing. Now, other people's may be about adding value. It may be about making things better. There are a number of things, but it's helping people understand what their why is, what their purpose is. And then the next step is, how do you do that? Just knowing that doesn't help. But that's what organizations need to do. Organizations need to think about how do I help people fulfill their why? How do I help them know what their why is? But then how do we help them do it? And then what does that look like? What does it look like when somebody's thriving, which is another question to ask?
Yeah.
What does it look like when your employees are thriving? What does it look like when your community's thriving? And we lose sight of that. We just go through the motions. There are organizations, and I'm sure they're nonprofits, like, hey, we fed the X number of people. We cared for X number of people. We gave X number of dollars back. Without asking, how did that change people's lives?
Yep.
Or did it just sustain them? What do you need to do as an organization to help people thrive?
Yeah. And our sector is improving in that arena, but still a long way to go. And we just talk about it as the difference between outputs and outcomes. We're really good at measuring outputs, how many people come through our programs, how many meals we deliver, how many, you know, books we put in the hands of kids. A bit less successful in saying what social impact that is actually making for them as individuals and for the greater community. So, and what you're talking about here, and I think these four C's, everything you're talking about there is back to, I mean, there's academic frameworks for this all over the place. Self-determination theory. People want three things. They want autonomy. That's that, you know, sense of, I have some decision-making ability and power in how my job gets done. I'm trusted. They want competence, meaning they want to master what they do. People want to feel like they know what they're doing and they're good at it, and they want to know that they're getting better at it. And then third is relatedness. They want to relate to their leader, and they want to relate to the mission. And I mean, these are these connections: itself, others, its mission. It's pretty simple stuff. And one of the biggest revelations I had years ago, and I harp on this a lot now with my coachees, is that leaders don't motivate people. Leaders help connect people's existing motivations, their why, with the work that needs to be done. If I can make that connection, That's where the motivation's right. happening. Not I'm going to motivate you. I'm going to put this motivation inside you. That's not how it works.
Man, I know the listeners can't see it, but you just got a double thumbs up.
Oh, that's it. Yeah. Man, I have so many more questions. Like when are we getting back to normal right now? I know the answer to that. I want to ask you two final questions. I wish we could go on, but I want to wrap it up. Two questions I like to ask all my guests, Ira. And one is, clearly you've done a lot of research and thinking about this. I mean, your life is built on this now. What brought you to this point? And in an answer to that question, who is a leader in your life at any point in your life who you would say has had maybe the or one of the greatest impacts on how you view leadership today and who you are? And why is that?
Yeah, I'm going to give you two answers. Okay. One is an academic answer and one is a personal answer. And one is my uncle, who just turned 91, still very close to him, grew up with him. He was probably a father to me in many ways. Again, it was just following his lead. And maybe that's where that contribute why came from. He's just always looked out. Everything he does was always looking out for can I benefit someone else? And it's not taking care of somebody else. Can I help people stand on their feet? It wasn't that he just donated money and gave things away and gave his time, but it was always, how can he help somebody to get back on their feet and move forward independently? And I guess my lesson was, and my granddaughter, who's now 22, you know, went through adolescence and some of the issues. And she says, I still remember when you told me you will do anything to help me succeed, but I'm not going to lift a finger to help you fail.
Wow. That's powerful.
The other person is Warren Bennis. And I mentioned him before.
Yeah.
And I think this, anyway, he reading him and how he looked at leadership, he was the one that introduced me to VUCA. The term VUCA, he introduced the world to VUCA. That was his, you know, his model. But Warren Bennis is probably a leader that I just admire. The light turned on when I read his definition of the difference between management and leadership.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I can relate. That all resonates with me, and I can feel it and hear it coming out of our conversations today. I appreciate the authenticity and I appreciate the enlightenment, really, that I think we're not bringing a lot of answers out here today. There's a way for people to get more answers and more help from you, and we're going to get to that in a minute, but just pausing to ask these questions and think about what's really happening and not be in denial and know that there's hope. All of those things I think are valuable. My last question for you, Ira, is if you had 20 seconds with a megaphone and an audience of all the leaders in the world, what's your big message? What's your number one tenet of leadership that you think all leaders should keep in mind? Just that little tiny question for you there as we wrap the show.
I think it goes back to something that Warren Bennis had said, and again, changed my view, is, you know, managers get people to do what they want them to do, and leaders get people to want to do what you want them to do. Mm. And that has always been, you know, and you know, no matter what level of leadership is, how can we make the place a better world? How can we help people have that autonomy? How can we help people have hope in the world? How can we help people grow and thrive? That's ultimately my purpose.
I love it. And you know, that's Dwight Eisenhower's definition of leadership. The art of getting people to do things you want done because they want to do it. I love it. We're kindred spirits there, Ira. I think we're on the same page in a lot of areas. I appreciate the work that you're doing. Folks, if you want to know more, the best place I can direct you is irawolf.com. That's Wolf with an E at the end. IRAWolf with an E at the end. .com. And that'll take you to all kinds of other resources, ways that you can get in touch with Ira, ways that you can learn more. There's so many more questions we didn't get to. You know, what are these sort of top skills that people need to be developing, and how can company culture impact growth and innovation, and how do we implement things like the adaptability quotient? What do they mean, and all these things? Go to that. And by the way, the book, even though it was 2017 with a second edition in 2020, it hits today. It hits right now. So it's Recruiting in the Age of Googlization. There is a new book coming out on which Ira is a co-author. It'll come out sometime in the fall, and you're going to love this. It's Create Great Culture in a Remote World. And I think, I'll bet you every single one of our listeners right now will find that relevant. So go do that. Ira, thanks again. This was awesome. I appreciate what you're doing. And folks, lead on.